following program was produced by Clock Tower Radio, clocktower.org, and is broadcast in partnership with Wave Farms WGXC 90.7 FM.
This is Charles Ruas welcoming you to a program from my audio archives from the 1970s. As Director of Arts Programming at WBAI-FM, the Pacifica radio station in New York City, I produced programs that covered all the contemporary arts, including drama, literature, and experimental radio programs as well.
With the cooperation of Clock Tower, these programs have been restored for broadcast on Clock Tower Radio, operating at clocktower.org.
Alex Haley reading from Roots.
Their abandoned village had begun going to pieces before they could bring themselves to return. They had no crops yet, and not much food or strength. "We will die out without our young people," said one of the old men. Omaro had listened closely as they talked, and his words were slow as he spoke. "My brother's village, which is 4 days distant, will welcome you, grandfathers." But all of them began shaking their heads as the oldest said, "This is our village. No other well has such sweet water. No other tree's shade is as pleasant. No other kitchens smell of the cooking of our women." The old men apologized that they had no hospitality hut to offer. Omaro assured them that he and his son enjoyed sleeping under the stars. And that night, after a simple meal of bread from their headloads, which they shared with the villagers, Kunta lay on his pallet of green, springy boughs and thought about all he had heard. Suppose it had been Jufere, with everybody he knew dead or taken away. Omaro, Binta, Lamine, and himself too. And the baobab burned, and the yards filled with trash. Kunta made himself think about something else. Then, suddenly, in the darkness, he heard the shrieks of some forest creature caught by some ferocious animal, and he thought about people catching other people. In the distance, he could also hear the howling of hyenas, but rainy season or dry, hungry or harvest, every night of his life he had heard hyenas howling somewhere. Tonight, he found their familiar cry almost comforting as he finally drifted off to sleep. I remember being intrigued by the way those villages were. There's some place else. It was also during that journey that he was making with his father, a lady who always stuck in my mind. You know, it's funny how you can write something and it then becomes an image always in your mind, that thing. But your image comes from what you wrote, and you kind of wonder where you got it in the first place. They had come to a similar village which had been razed, and there was a lady sitting alone, reduced to utter poverty. Nothing left, and she apologized very sweetly and said, "I'm very sorry, but I have nothing but tea I can offer you." And she gave them tea, all done in a very courtly manner. And they had the tea, and he left her a little something and went on. That always stuck in my mind.
I was so impressed with the insistent, "There is nothing as sweet as the water from our well."
Me too. And, you see, we all do that if we get rooted somewhere And that sort of comes around to the thing, I guess, of why I call the book Roots. It is universal. If we have roots, no water is as sweet. There are people who will swear to you that something, the water in New York is better than the water in Los Angeles, you know, or whatever. And no air is as clean. And you can smell the cooking of our women's pots or whatever. And I guess that's pretty universal. That's the way we are, all of us.
You're listening to Charles Ruas interviewing Alex Haley, author of Roots, published by Doubleday.
When we were talking about enclaves before, ethnic enclaves, that's what it is, you know, soul food. I grew up all my early life eating soul food. We didn't know it was that. It was just something to eat. That was the way you people cooked. I delight in going around to the ethnic restaurants in the, you know, in Los Angeles, New York, Chicago, wherever I happen to be, and sharing other people's sweet water and clean air in cuisine terms.
Your research began by going back to your relatives and drawing the oral tradition from them. But at some point, you must have decided that this was a quest that was much larger than just family history.
Sure. You're absolutely right. I, at a point, became aware that I was dealing with the saga of a people as opposed to the story of my family. And the reason for that simply is because black people have, to such a huge degree, the same common denominator ancestry pattern. Every single black person ancestrally traces back to someone who lived in some African village, was captured in some way, put on some slave ship, brought across the same ocean, into some succession of plantations, on up to the Civil War, emancipation, and that day to this day struggle for freedom in its various facets. And that the story of any one is the saga of all. That's what I became aware of.
I'm also curious about your awareness of when you understood that the saga of all would also be a definition in terms of yourself.
I suppose that occurred when I made the first trip into the village of Jufere, and the people there clustered around me staring, and I realized first with great shock I'd never had been in a crowd, and I was the only one my complexion, brown you might say, and everybody else was just jet black. And it was so striking, I mean they were so much so, that I felt hybrid, impure among the pure. One of the interpreters came over and said to me, "Why they stare at you so, they have never here seen a black American." And it was that which gave me the comprehension. They had not been looking at me as an individual, but collectively as a people, a symbol of a people. And I think it was out of that that I began to get the concept that what I had to write then was the saga of a people.
Did you feel a strong division between wanting to identify completely with African culture and at the same time being an American after all?
Somehow it never occurred to me as a division. I think it registered more to me as a fusion, the one into the other. Either way you go, either Afro-American back into African or African forward into Afro-American. And that phenomenon, in a certain sense, is, I hope, reflected in my dealing with Kunta, the African. As you know, you've read it, the growing up with him in the village, so you know the African culture when you get done with him there. And then the slave ship experience. You know, in the slave ship, that was cathartic for him to come to grips with himself. All he knew was his African culture and terror of the moment. And you see, I have Kunta as, in my mind, symbolic of all those Africans. He was clutching for years, for the rest of his life that we know him, to hold on to what he had psychically brought with him from Africa. And I really didn't ever think about it as a division. And I think the reason I reacted to it that way when you asked me was that that concept of it startled me. I really have just thought of the fusion.
The reason I asked about division is that your technique, when you write about Africa, is third person and novelistic.
Mm.
And as you come closer and closer to yourself, then I'm terribly aware that the narrative and the oral tradition are fused until we get to the I, the first person mm-hmm. narrative. Mm. And it was the beginning of the book in the third person that made me wonder about the distance between you and the subject.
Well, there was obviously just a time difference. Obviously, when I'm writing about what happened in Africa in the 1750s and 60s, I'm writing about something very distant from me in all respects except psychically and just pure research. I'm writing about facts I learned in Africa and in London and hither or yon about what was the culture of Africa like at that time. Now, I'm much more at home once they got to these shores, simply because this is the culture in which I've been reared and, to whatever degree is the case, educated.
Did you find that the descriptions of Africa, as you said, awakened psychic echoes?
The descriptions of Africa?
Yes, and also, as you described his experiences in Africa, I was wondering if all of the data kept awakening a sense of familiarity?
I wouldn't say that. This is simply because I was not of Africa, but of this country. In fact, what awakened the psychic echoes were people. You look at people, and you know you come from these people. And it seems all the more poignant, sometimes even hauntingly so, that you look at people and you realize how distant you and these people have become to the degree that you view each other almost with astonishment, with wonder, and yet they are your cousins in the generic sense. And then maybe you start taking some broader views about the social conditions existing here and there which have brought this into being, that you and they, who in fact are cousins, look at each other as odd objects.
My question must tell you that I was wondering about the whole problem of racial memory in the Jungian sense, that you are dealing with individuals and the people who are your family. And at some point, it broadens out, as
right,
you said,
right.
to include yeah. everybody.
Yes, that's right.
And I was wondering if, for example, the descriptions of African culture at some point awakened something in you that was very familiar, that made you realize that you were familiar with it through the veils of all the generation mm. and all the different narrative viewpoints.
Mm. That could be. You know, I'm sitting here as you're saying that thing, and I'm reacting to it not out of immediate feeling, yeah, that's right, but I'm realizing that that probably is right, but it would register not so much in a surface sense with me. It's a subjective thing.
Mm-hmm.
What you're saying, too, makes me think sometimes I didn't finish school. I'm not bragging about or complaining. I'm just stating as a fact. So I don't know a lot of academic-type things. I taught myself to write. Just I was a cook, mm-hmm. you know, and started writing and stuff. And I'm saying that only to say that it bemuses me lots of times when now, say I'll go to some school of journalism seminar, and I'm the speaker, and people will, very much as you are doing right now, and obviously you know a whole lot of things that are academic of nature.
Yes.
And students who have read something I had written, read it very carefully and analytically, will sit and they'll start saying to me, well, I notice here you use this technique or you did that thing or this or that or the other. And I'm sure they're right, but I just don't know what the hell they're talking about. And I'm not trying to be little boy blue, naive or something. I'm just telling you the truth is whatever things of these nations, they happen. Now, I'll tell you this much. I believe of that book, Roots, that it is meant to be. Now, I feel about it. I don't care how that may sound melodramatic or whatever. I really, truly feel that the book was meant by the power beyond us to occur in this time, in this place. I feel rather as if I was a conduit through whom it got written. And the reason I say that is because there were so many times in so many ways that if this or that or the other had not happened, which I had nothing to do with, if that piece hadn't fit in, the whole would never have occurred. It's shuddery to think some of the things I did or got involved in that were seemingly just accidental, and yet they were a piece that fit, particularly in the earlier stages when it was nebulous beyond nebulous. One time I was up in the National Archives right after I'd finished writing the autobiography of Malcolm X, and I just had an afternoon to kill. That's the only reason I was in there. I had something to do that night. I was in Washington. And I got to think, because it was in the 60s, and there was a lot more talk and thought in people's minds about black people, about Africa. I asked this man, this attendant, if he would get for me the microfilm records of the census of Alamance County, North Carolina, 1870. Now, my reason for that was simply that my grandmother, who had told me the story of the family so much, always had talked about how she was born in Alamance County. Her parents had been slaves, that her older sisters had been born into slavery there and so forth. And I knew that 1870 would have been the first census following the Civil War. And I found myself staring down, turning the crank, these old fashioned handwritings, F's look like S's, names after names after names of people. And it was intriguing, no end, and I just turned and looked and so forth. Intriguing as it was, after maybe a couple hours, it just got boring, so I decided I'd quit. None of it was any big deal because, as I say, I just killing an afternoon. And so I left my stuff there, and I started out, and I went down through the, there's a big genealogical reading room. And when I got down through there, I just stopped. Now, what had happened was something had caught my eye, vision, peripheral vision sort of thing. And that is that in libraries, and I've been in a lot of them, people are generally sitting back, relaxed, trying to read whatever they're reading, comfortable as possible. And I happen to notice that in this place, unlike anything I'd ever seen, people were bent over the tables, raptly studying whatever they had in their hand. Some of them had magnifying glasses. And I could see glancing about, they were all studying some kind of old document. And a thought just came into my head, was simply an involuntary thought, was these people are trying to find out who they are. And with no one, I just went back up in there and kept turning microfilm. Well, a couple of hours later, I found myself looking down on the name of my grandmother's father and her mother, her older sisters, there in the microfilm. Now, it wasn't that I hadn't believed my grandmother, because you did not believe my grandmother, but the point was, there was something about seeing those names, those words she had spoken there in the official records of the United States, in the National Archives, the same building that housed the original Constitution, for that matter. And that was what hooked me. Now, the thing I think about, how what evoked my telling you this, was when you had spoken of the capriciousness of it, and you're right. Suppose I had just kept on walking back down onto the sidewalk, I'm sure I would have never given it a second thought. The book Roots wouldn't even exist. I really devoutly think, I don't think I would ever give it another thought beyond maybe some fleeting reminiscence of my grandmother having told the story. But as it would turn out, with that would begin the next 12 years of what would develop into just obsessive work, which has gone into this book.
I was wondering, since your family in its many generations and the changes, you can trace one of your descendants as a professor. Was there a tendency to accumulate facts just simply to keep the record straight so that you grew up with a sense of the importance of that basic information?
I didn't grow up with a sense of the importance of it, because I was just a boy and a kid, and I didn't have whatever kind of orientation would have made me able to assess the importance of it. But I grew up thoroughly aware of and immersed in awareness that my family did have a very great sense of its history. Simply, I heard, how could you be other than aware? My grandmother, the way she talked about it, the way obviously others had talked about it. And I think it was the kind of thing like when we say that old chicken and egg thing, which is more important, environment or heredity. Well, my guess is, if I had to take it, I'd take environment every time. There is a psychic environment that's just as important, if not more important, than the physical environment. And the psychic environment within which one grew up in my family was strongly with a sense of identity and of pride and so forth. And that had a lot to do with us. I know I'm talking about my brothers and myself. We've talked about my younger brothers.
Let me ask you some questions about your research and what you learned, sort of leaving the book aside for a moment. Did you arrive at some assessment of why, for example, in the United States, Black Americans have so little sense of roots linking Absolutely. Themselves to Africa?
That's easy. So many slaves were sold back and forth that their children grew up knowing little, if indeed often nothing, about their parents. The lines, the continuity lines were broken too often. Not every family was sold apart and all that, but the potentiality of a continuum story gathering as it did in my family just by circumstances would be very small. If Kizzy had been sold earlier, if she'd been sold when she was 8 instead of 16, what could they have been? And then she told the story to her son and told it definitively enough that he told it, and the thing just became a pattern within the family. And now the odds of that happening are very, very slender, because people got sold so much, even as they got sold in this book. But either they were old enough to know the story when they were sold, or they were sold as a family unit.
You don't think it's an essential part of the English culture from which American culture derives, that is, to ignore other culture? I marked off a passage where you describe the culture of Haiti that they hear about, or even New Orleans, I suppose, where there's not only interbreeding, but there's a cultural interbreeding, so that certain forms of African culture survive, although as a hybrid,
sure,
Catholicism and the worship of nature in the form of voodoo, and various other cultural phenomenons that continue, but as a hybrid.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow, in the United States, you don't get a sense of like one culture being able to receive the other. I mean, it seems to work both ways. And I was wondering if at some point in the research you sort of got an insight into why that is here. The distances
between
cultures. Yes, in the United States.
Because, you know, it may be something, ironically, as things so often are ironic, that the very fact or concept of a melting pot nation would cause people to be more enclavish within that melting pot. It's like, in another ironic way, somebody was saying to me, isn't it interesting that Roots would be written by a gypsy? And that's true. Somebody who was a very rooted person wouldn't be traveling around and running around as I did in the course of writing that book. I think that somehow, and I'm not offering an explanation because I don't know, but I'm just saying I think it probably is because we are such a melting pot that we more strongly cling to ethnic identities, each bringing certain strengths, some cases maybe certain negatives, whatever. But in a certain another way, the strength of the fusion, the melting pot fusion, derives out of the individuals and the fiercely proud individuals of their own particular singularity. Let me ask you something.
What?
After Kunta, who obviously is the major character, who to you is the, if I use the expression, favorite character other than Kunta?
I was most impressed. I selected a passage with the family's reaction to the liberation.
The Murray family.
Yes. And what happened to them afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
I was, first of all, astonished by the way you characterized the family sort of wanting freedom, whereas from reading so many Southern writers, my idea had been that people stayed pretty much where they were and tried to struggle with the circumstances, and my notion had always been that Reconstruction victimized both Black and white, that is, wiped out the Southern culture.
Well, it didn't wipe it out. It just, it affected it severely. It affected the way it had been, the antebellum culture. But the book ends on the line, which makes some comment on what you were just saying, that a great problem in our culture has been having to do with not just Black history, but history per se, out of the fact that preponderantly histories have been written by the winners. That's why you got that impression, say, from things you read. Right. And I'm not saying this to indict anybody who wrote any book. I'm just talking about a social
phenomenon,
tendency.
Yes.
And it's almost like one of these self-fulfillment things, you know, that if the projection is made that Blacks are happy as slaves, then you can't project that they were anxious to be free. One of them is obviously wrong. And there are many things like that which occurred within slavery. The ways that a myth or a euphemism would be established that would help support the fact that slaves were being held as slaves. You know, that Blacks are stupid, just inherently stupid. And there are many generations of people who have been born and gone to their graves totally invested with that concept. Now, where that leads us is if you had been brought up, as you might well have, with that concept, it's nothing indicting you because you merely were receiving what society offered you as an opinion. But then, say, when you and I meet, it would simply say that you would glance at me and think stupid. And it's not the case. Now, conversely, I know where I grew up, very frequently there were, you know, a number of Blacks who felt, because they had been given these things to think, that all whites were venal, vicious, morally wanton in the sense of what they would do to somebody and so forth. Now, there are prototype stupid Blacks and venal, vicious whites, but they certainly, in neither case, are the average run of people in either group. But cliches have a way of being adhesive. And that's why you would feel and do feel, or, you know, a head felt, whichever tense applies, what you have just said.
Right, because basically they remain agricultural until finally the railroad brings in industrialized vision, so that by getting a job on a Pullman, finally you have a larger view.
As you read, my father was a Pullman porter, and
yes,
at the time he was a porter, that was about the biggest job a Black could have.
But I was sort of amazed that the concept of freedom, which runs throughout your book, that is from Gambia on, the whole valuing of freedom essentially for its own sake, as opposed to valuing like other cultural traits like the ability to endure or face up to. All of your characters have a sort of intense yearning towards freedom.
Well, I think that is borne out. There isn't much in the book that I feel more valid than that, based on all the things I've been able to study. Of course they wanted to be free. The very idea of that you couldn't leave the confines of where you were. It was just modified imprisonment. It didn't matter whether one necessarily wanted to leave Georgia and get to New York or to Ohio or to wherever freedom existed. But it was just, if one could have the right, if he felt like it or if she felt like it, to walk 10 miles down the road and come on back home. But you couldn't leave to walk the 10 miles in its most elemental way. That was what being a slave meant. You were bound worse than physically. Your movements were dictated by your condition. Like people often talk, there was a book, or two books, I think, where those two professors from up in Syracuse University wrote about, I think it was Time on the Cross, and their projection was that most masters were not as cruel as had been portrayed. And there are lots of cases of masters who were very devoted to their slaves, but they are a very, very distinct minority. And I remember when I first heard the concept of those books, that just to my mind and across my mind flashed mental images of all the photographs I had seen of people's backs like lattice work with scars from beatings and so forth. And now, so I'm not saying that every plantation's slaves were beaten till their backs looked like lattice work. Nor, on the other hand, God knows I'm not saying that every plantation was where there was a, quote, good master. Even where there was a, quote, good master, you see, the real consideration is not whether or not the master was good or less so, but that in any event, if he existed as a master, he did not alter the condition of the slave. That's the thing that mattered. To be a slave is a condition that flouts the meaning of man in the free sense. So I'm sort of wondering from what you originally asked me, but I tend to wonder. If you ask me something else, I'll try to stay more closely to it.
I was wondering also, just as there's the stereotype of being attached to the soil, to farming, that is an agricultural state of mm-hmm. existence, in your book, three times, there are very sort of violent conflicts, cultural conflict. One is, of at the beginning, when the slave is brought over from Africa to work as a slave, to sort of somehow adapt himself to the condition mm-hmm. of slavery. And once again, there's a violent sort of conflict. After the Civil War, again, there's sort of a violent adjustment. And then in the writing of the book in the 60s, there seems to have been a sort of violent, in the sense of explosive, consciousness. And I was wondering if you saw a parallel or a meaning to these events.
Well, I really don't necessarily see a parallel to them. I really just kind of react to them at each in its way, at in its time. There's a kind of linkage between them. You can see how the second grew out of the first and the third out of the combination of the first and second, clearly. But I never really saw them as a parallel so much. I hadn't really thought about them, see. You are like I was telling you about when you go to the seminar. It's the truth. You go to one of them, and I was feeling pretty, you know, pretty confident and everything when I went there because I wrote the book we're going to talk about,
right.
You know. So you feel obviously you're on top of this. And then you get about 35 good, sharp students who read this book you wrote. And by the time they get through with you and commending what you wrote, nobody's knocking what you wrote, they're commending it, but telling you how you did it. And you get back on the plane as befuddled. It takes you 2-3 days to get over one of these seminars and get back to work. That's the truth.
You mean the idea of the history here?
Well, the whole thing of the assessment. You know, the thing I'm finding kind of really fascinating is reading reviews. Unfortunately, as you have seen, some of them, Roots is getting just great. Sometimes he's even rave reviews. Naturally, I'm very, very happy about that, and I'm reading them with great, great interest. And what I'm kind of looking for down the line, I think if patterns follow, is that after this first round, then there will be the less frequent reviews, which will come where people like yourself have gone back for another reading, or maybe a third reading, and do not so much reviews as commentaries, essays that begin to crop up in different places. I had a guy telling me yesterday about a historian, professional historian, had reviewed history, and his pitch wasn't, or had almost nothing to do with the book as a popular nonfiction type candidate, but he's viewing it as a historical document. The book itself. And I'm looking very much forward to reading his thing because the guy's going to send it to me, what he said. And I'm be anxious to learn.
I am seeing it as a historical document. Why do you say that it's not?
I'm not disagreeing. I think it is. I'm just curious as to the means by which he will establish his statement that it is. A friend, a mutual friend, described to me what this fellow had written. And it was that he was seeing it in, I suppose, in a sense of it's being, one, like a scholarly history for study purposes, and two, a historical document in the sojourn of the black people, the document which will sort of supply, to some degree, to a considerable degree, hopefully, the missing sense of identity and of heritage.
I see. I didn't mean to be that particular when I said I thought of it as a historical document. Working in media, for example, and perhaps television more than radio, it's sort of amazing to me how everything exists in this rootless present, a sort of a time-encapsulated, valueless, historyless situation, comedy. Mm. So that the whole notion of roots is important across the board, I mean, for everyone.
That's right, it is. Another moving thing to me about the book, what the responses which are coming to it, it's obviously a totally black story. And as big as the black reaction is to it positively, I have never, just as one thing has popped my head, I've never been kissed as much as I have lately in my life. And I'm getting to really like this writing business. I mean, just girls just come up and grab you and, wow, you know, you did this for us, smack, you know, great, and, you know, beautiful. That's a sort of jocular way of saying that the black reaction to the book is emotional. But scarcely less of a reaction is the white reaction through association that's almost instant. What about my people? What about my family? Where are we from? An interesting little thing I've noticed is I believe most black people tend to think that virtually all white people can trace themselves back to William the Conqueror. I have found, at least my general impression is, that's far from true. Most white people can't go back but a few generations, same as black people. It's just that interesting the concept exists that white people can all go back yonder, 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 but they can't. The fact is at odds with the concept, with the image. And the counter thing is the image most people hold blacks is they can't go anywhere. It's almost as if we sprang into being on the plantations. That's the general image many people, black and white, have. Now, it's obviously not so. Everybody on earth has the same amount of lineage. It's just a question of can you document it or not? Or what has been the image framework within which one might have documented. There are many, many, many black people who, say, suffused with the image that you had no history, would sit right there with a living great-grandmother right in the house and never ask her, could she tell them anything about the family, which could conceivably take them back two generations beyond herself, or maybe three, simply because the image was such. Not only was the image that they couldn't find anything, but also, the social image was that Africa was such a caricature in the things we've seen that one would be reluctant to go poking into that. Who wants to be related to some Neo-Simian people if that's what you tend to think in your mind? You just would rather just let it be and don't bother it. Let that rest. One of the things that thrilled me was my own discoveries of the things which you have read in that book. I mean, I can remember times I just felt high with things I had found were the case in the African culture centuries past.
You talk about being victimized as a child by the whole Tarzan concept of Africa as an unknown continent without a history.
Well, see, in Henning, Tennessee, nobody spoke about Africans, and you passed over Africa, a geography book, in 2 days, notwithstanding the fact that it was the second largest continent on Earth physically. But I'll tell you something that illustrates, again, this point of history written by the winners and the effect of it. In this country, I know I did, and I think probably most people who, whatever race or whatever, were in school around the third grade, were taught as gospel, Columbus discovered America. Now, at that time, our little formative minds in the shaping were not given any accompanying information to raise in our minds the question, whom did he find there? And it's kind of amusing on surface, but if you look just beneath it, you see there a whole society teaching its generations that one, nothing mattered before Columbus, that two, a whole race of people, the American Indian, didn't matter enough even to mention in that same context. And that's something to reflect upon, how our images are shaped by erroneous things or half-truths or distortions or omissions or whatever. And it's been the same thing with black people in this country. Very, very few people here, including blacks, know really much of anything about the true, what might be called, hegira of black people. I hope to have aided the correction of that with the book Roots. It doesn't indict anybody. That was another one of my big things. I had no syllable in it have I wanted to, or have I believe, said, look what these awful people did to those people. Never once. The book simply tells a chronicle from the point of view of the people in the book. And then you, the reader, write your own editorial. Like, take of it what you will.
What about your view of Africa now with the leaky discovery and the fact that the whole concept of, like, Columbus discovered America is so limited?
There is a saying I like on that score, and it's something like, if you change the attitude, you change the thing. We are now in the process of starting to accept that Africa is something more than a Tarzan image. And so we have scientists, anthropologists, all sorts of people. They are now studying seriously, trying to find what can they get from the culture.
I was just thinking, this is to pursue sort of the realm of fantasy, but that even in the Tarzan adventures, it's also a continent filled with, like, great kingdoms, lost treasures, mm-hmm. ruins of civilization mm-hmm. that have been forgotten, people, great cultures that have isolated themselves
True.
Because the world doesn't deserve to know mm-hmm. them.
But always
corrupt.
In the context of Tarzan saving it or something.
And I'm
not
seeing what
whatever,
you mean.
But see, it was
right.
always presented the dominant figure was
yes.
Tarzan. And the way these things were presented then was exotica, against which he operated, like Superman. You never saw a heroic African in Africa, which is significant. I mean, I'm telling you, we never read of one, and there are. You take heroic figures like Sanjata, just dozens of people who, in fact, are in the African culture, but we never heard of them outside that culture, not on any broad scale.
I wanted to ask you, you make Gambia Muslim in the book.
It is Muslim.
It is Muslim now. Did you want the juxtaposition of, like, Christian slave traders and a Muslim culture?
I didn't want that. That's the way it was. It was absolutely Muslim at that time. One of the secondary resources in research that I had were the long journals in longhand of the Quaker and Wesleyan missionaries who went in to try and contain the Muslim influence. It's been Muslim for at least 400 years, preponderantly. And so I wasn't wanting, you know, it's fine, but I wasn't setting that up. That is the way it was. Speaking of the Christian influence, a thing that bemused me on not a few times was reading in so many, many slave ship logs and other documents of that kind, was how they were just full of religious-type references. Say, a slave ship log's captain would be writing, with God's help, we will get this batch safely ashore with not too many losses, or something like that. Do you know the song Amazing Grace?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the man who wrote that song, you know who wrote that song? John yeah. Newton, a retired slave ship captain. And he wrote How Sweet the Name of Jesus Sounds. He wrote other hymns, numerous hymns. After his career as a slaver, he retired. And then he repented and he was saved and he wrote these songs. And I don't know what I'm saying, except it's ironic. You think of the lyrics. Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost and now I'm found, was blind, but now I see. And I don't question the validity of his conversion, I just say it was ironic that mm-hmm. this particular song and others of its kind were written by a retired slave ship captain.
I was wondering if you came across, for example, in the Kingdom of Dahomey, where the king would sell conquered people as slaves, which is a practice since time immemorial.
It wasn't just in the Kingdom of Dahomey. That was all up and down the coast. Yeah, that was all up and down the coast. What tended to happen, of course, we're talking oversimplified, broad-scale things. The ships would come in, and they would bring in their cargoes guns. They were called African guns. They were particular shoddy kind of guns that were made for the specific purpose of trading. And the one ship would swap guns for slaves to one king. Now, the king had gotten the slaves by some kind of war thing as a rule. You know, you declare a war on a village and the prisoners were sold as, quote, punishment, something like that. Another ship would supply another village with arms. And what gradually began to happen was a state of endemic warfare, whose result was a steady flow of slaves to those ships. It wasn't just a home, but no, it was much more widespread. In fact, it was pervasive. Chapter that opens when Kunta's on the slave ship. He wakes up, finds himself on a slave ship. Kunta wondered if he had gone mad. Naked, chained, shackled, he awoke on his back between two other men in a pitch darkness full of steamy heat and sickening stink and a nightmarish bedlam of shrieking, weeping, praying, and vomiting. He could feel and smell his own vomit on his chest and belly. His whole body was one spasm of pain from the beatings he had received in the 4 days since his capture, but the place where the hot iron had been put between his shoulders hurt the worst.
Did that sort of like make you wonder about like the Second World War and the fact that history is always about one people destroying the essence of another?
Yeah, well, what I think is in a broader context even than that is that, you know, I really get bemused by the fact that we have here the physical world, we have the facilities within ourselves and materially, literally to make this earth a utopia, living utopia. And when you reflect upon, observe what we are instead doing with it, one feels we should collectively fall on our knees and beg forgiveness. That's the way I feel about it. I really do. All of us. We will prefer to hate to loving. We will prefer negative into positive. You can scarcely find anything decent, pleasant to read in a whole newspaper. We prefer to be alarmed, upset, titillated, than to be reassured or whatever. And it says something about us. I'm not sure what. I wish I did know. This is before the auction. They are off the slave ship now. They've been 7 days in a holding prison. waiting for the auction. And this paragraph, which is short, is just after the seventh morning gruel, two-bob, and I interject two-bob as the Mandinka word for white men, entered the barred room with an armload of clothes. One frightened man after another was unchained and shown how to put them on. One garment covered the waist and legs, a second the upper body. When Kunta put them on, his sores, which had begun to show signs of healing, immediately started itching.
This morning, you know, just about 4:30, hesitating blues were knocking on my door. Tell me how long. Do I have to wait? Can I get you now, baby? Do I have to hesitate?
You've been listening to Charles Ruas in conversation with Alex Haley, author of Roots, published by Doubleday.
Tell me how long.
The program was produced by Mike Moss. Technical direction by Dave Marks. Recorded by Miles Smith. Thank you for listening.
That's for y'all guitar people in London to get your learning, you understand? It's just for you to get your learning, see? Get out in the public, you know. You learn how to do it. I got hesitating shoes and hesitating stockings. I got me a good hesitating woman to do my hesitating rocking. Tell me how long. You had hesitating. There's a pie bag, you know, going around to everybody's house trying to break up everybody's home. It's your pie bag, hear what you tell them, you know. I ain't no preacher, neither no preacher's son. But I can preach a few sermons until the preacher comes. Tell me how long. You have to wait. Some of you women fall for that kind of stuff, you know. Break up your good home. I ain't no rent payer, neither no rent payer son, but I can pay a few rent until the rent payer comes. Tell me how long. Never been to heaven, but I've been told. Says St. Peter learned the angels how to do the jelly roll. Can I get you now? Well, I hitched up my mule and my mule wouldn't pull. I took the harness off the mule and put the harness on the bull. Tell me how. Can I get you now? Crooked woman, you know. I was out on my wagon, you know, trying to sell some coal. My gal was sleeping around the corner doing her best to sell some jelly roll.
This is Charles Ruas. You've been listening to a selection from my historic archives.
With the cooperation of Clock Tower, these programs have been restored for broadcast on Clock Tower Radio, operating at clocktower.org.
The previous program was produced by Clock Tower Radio, clocktower.org. And is broadcast in partnership with Wave Farms WGXC 90.7 FM.